Good evening, this is Barbara Glickstein, and you're listening to Health Styles on WBAI. Health Styles is brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College. Learn more about us at centerforhealthmediapolicy.com, where you can find our blog, HealthCetera. Tonight's guest is Zachary Berger. He holds a medical degree and a PhD. He's a primary care doctor and an internist, as well as an epidemiologist. He's an assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and he has a medical practice in adult medicine. His research areas of interest are doctor-patient communication, bioethics, and epidemiology. Welcome to Health Styles, Dr. Berger.
Thanks for having me.
And may I call you Zach during the interview?
Please do.
All right, I will. And just for full transparency, actually, Zach Berger and I know each other for a number of years, and it's a pleasure to have you opposite me in this interview, knowing about our shared interest in health and healthcare, and particularly around the focus of making the best of communication as a critical point in helping people get healthy and be healthy. You recently published a book, and the title of it is Talking to Your Doctor. It's published by Rowan and Littlefield and just came out, right?
Yes, it did, just a couple weeks ago.
All right, so congratulations on that. Having looked at and read your book, I would say it's a call to action. It's filled with a lot of information and a lot of great references and resources. And I think that call to action, as I experienced it reading it, is really about your desire to create a culture of healthy communication. This idea that we're in a time of healthcare reform, a time of change, a time where perhaps some of the structural and operational changes of healthcare reform will really allow for room for this shift of culture. Is that a fair appraisal?
I think that's right. You know, I think I am certainly not the first or the last to realize that we live in a time of accelerating change in the healthcare sector. And people see that change as an opportunity in many different ways. You know, you have people that are real boosters of and acolytes for electronic health information, which I agree is important. And their view is that in this time of change, everything will be revolutionized through through this new organization of data. Or some people think that the change will come through people advocating for themselves and exercising their own opinion about their health. And those two things are very important. I feel like that independence only goes so far and computerization technology only goes so far, that good healthcare is built around relationships between people and their providers. And that's what we need to center things around.
You know, your book is filled with advice, and again, the title of your book is Talking to Your Doctor, A Patient's Guide to Communication in the Exam Room and Beyond. It's just been released by Rowan and Littlefield. And in addition to some very good advice, you provide a lot of evidence that points you share are solidly supported by a lot of evidence and some of your own research. I really love this statement in your preference. You state, and I quote, "Thanks to the new science of doctor-patient communication, the seeds of which were planted 30 years ago today, we now understand that communication is not squishy, but can be quantified and made rigorous." I just love that you had the word squishy and some other great words that are throughout the book. What's not squishy about the science, Zach?
I think there are widely used and validated ways to measure what goes on between a doctor, and when I say doctor, it's really a shorthand, and maybe an unfortunate shorthand in a way of referring to all providers, what goes on between providers and a patient in the exam room. So we know how to measure, this is nothing I developed, of course, but something that's been around for a couple of decades. We know how to measure what kinds of statements are being used, how providers and patients share the space and time of the room, how satisfied provider and patient can be. So we know how to measure things. We know something, but not enough, about what patients think is important from a visit. What we don't know, but we're getting to know, is about how effective providers contextualize their advice for a patient's preferences. And that's where communication, I think, one way in which communication matters. It's taking the medical advice and contextualizing it to what a patient needs and wants, and bringing about, hopefully, better outcomes.
So is your book both for patients and healthcare providers, physicians, nurse practitioners, physician associates who practice primary care?
100%. I think, someone wrote me with a wonderful comment. They said, I started the book, and it looks like chapter one is really in a doctor's voice. Are you sure this book is for patients? And I said, well, you're right. chapter one is in a Shocker's voice because it's about me, you know, and my educational process. So yes, unfortunately, I come to it mostly from a provider perspective, but as the title shows, it's really for patients, and it's really, or as we call them, people, you know, anyone who interacts with the healthcare system. But it's really about, it's really for providers as well, and I think there's a lot of overlap. I don't think we have to say, you know, providers should take this way and patients should take it this way. I think we each have a lot to learn from the other.
You know, you mentioned, and as your first chapter really addresses, how you trained here in New York City at one of our major teaching hospitals. Talk a little bit about that and how that really created a stage for your interest in the research, in your research on communication.
I think one thing that really strikes me about New York City and returning it to it today after an absence, and maybe what that people in big cities take for granted, is the very diversity of the city. The different sorts of people, the different sorts of groups, and how the provider has to take not just group differences but individual differences into account. And knowing how the provider seeks a sort of unity and diversity, that is, you want to provide universal, you want to exercise universal virtues to people, you want to treat people with respect, you want to pay attention to people's preferences, you want to treat a person as an end and not a means, no matter how different the person is from you. And you have to respect their differences while doing that. And so the fact that a task of such difficulty was being carried out every day at Bellevue Hospital, where I trained, that's an inspiring thing. And that's really, I think, what heightened or piqued or created my interest in doctor-patient communication.
So you talk about diversity in the book, and you talk about cultural competency, a term that in our healthcare field we throw around a lot. Mm-hmm. And you've sort of described the in a very beautiful way, in a very beautiful narrative, what it means to value and to have that core value of meeting someone where they are and who they are. How much training did you get in medical school and in your residency on some of these core value virtues that you speak of in terms of cultural competency? And is that something that we're just putting in academic terms, or did you see it in practice?
Well, I guess to talk about my own training, it's been a little bit now, and I could say that NYU, where I was a medical student, has revamped its curriculum at least once, and probably more than once since that time. You know, when I trained, we did not get this. I think it's present now. As a resident in the primary care residency program at NYU Bellevue, I had the benefit and the exceptional benefit of having training that really centered on cultural competency as well as communication. I think the importance of those areas is becoming ever more realized, and I think it's diffused out into to the medical education community to an extent. Now, to the extent, you know, the extent to which such realization on the part of providers is being paired with practice in everyday life, that's a more difficult question. You know, you ask, for example, let's take the related but different area of shared decision making, but I'm familiar with the literature. If you ask a given doctor, do you think you and your patient should share the decision? You know, most doctors by now will say, sure. You know, they know what they're supposed to say. But if you observe the encounter, often as not, you'll find that that is not the case. And I wonder, when we talk about cultural competency and appreciation for diversity, if that's also the case. I think there's a lot of subconscious bias out there. So I think that's something to address.
I agree. And I think in addition to bias, it's really important that we talk a little bit about power and hierarchy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because in order to be in conversation and with respect for each other, we must take, I think, a moment and talk about power and talk about hierarchy, because it crosses the issues of race and mm-hmm. And social status as well as ethnicity, and we certainly all carry within ourselves the need and I hope the desire to address those biases when we are in relationships, particularly in a healthcare encounter. Mm-hmm. So what do you talk about? What should we talk about when we talk about power and hierarchy? And how can we advise our listeners to hear this in a way that will help them take on some of the knowledge and advice in your book?
That's a fascinating, I think, very important question. I would come at it perhaps in a slightly different way and talk about, you know, as a provider, perhaps my bias is looking at outcomes, looking at health outcomes and trying to make people healthier by their own lights. And we know that in outcomes, there is a lot of disparities, which, you know, is a term of art, as you know, meaning differences in care and outcomes between groups. And oftentimes these are racial groups, given our given our nation's sad history and often present. The question is how these disparities come about, and you can model it in many different ways. You can model it economically, you can model it racially, you can model it as a hierarchical endeavor. I think the benefit of looking at it in terms of power, which, you know, to be honest, something I haven't thought enough about, is that we realize that doctors and providers know less than we thought, that patients thought, than anybody thought, right? Because science is always incomplete, and we know that patients are people with their own desires, and the hierarchy has to be leveled. So we know that's the case. Now, and I think it's sometimes a task of saying, even if the person across from me, you know, is poor and of a different race and I'm well-heeled and of this race, that still applies, right? This person across from me, even if they didn't finish school, even if, you know, even if they've been, they've had a substance use disorder for much of their life, this person still has their wants and needs and preferences, right? To be able to say that over and over and over again, that takes practice. And no one's perfect at it, but I think that's a task to try and perfect.
You know, early on, before I entered nursing school, one of the first radio shows that I co-produced with Diana Mason, my co-host and co-producer of Health Styles, which is what you're tuned into and listening to, my guest is Dr. Zachary Berger, who is, in addition to a medical doctor, is a researcher with a PhD and is interested in research in the area of doctor-patient relationship, bioethics, and I left out that last one. What is that other area you're interested in?
I guess
epidemiology.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And is currently an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and he also practices adult medicine there. His book is Talking to Your Doctor, A Patient's Guide to Communication in the Exam Room and Beyond, just published and released by the publisher Rowan and Littlefield. We're talking about the issues that comprise the sort of foundations of good communication, as well as some of the obstacles and entrenched, if you will, issues that we're trying to break open and free ourselves from, all of us, both the providers and each one of us in the community, your family, as well as yourself. And so when we talk about issues of power and hierarchy, and as you mentioned, Zach, this idea that each person comes with their wants and their needs and this agenda, you talk about this in a way that almost makes me wonder, and I started saying that we did one of my first radio shows was how to use the emergency room. In fact, a lot of people are, as an example, you know, chastised for not knowing when they should use the emergency room. Mm-hmm. My first program early on, about 30 years ago now, was how do people find out how to use the emergency room? How do citizens find out how to communicate? So you wrote this book as a way of helping address those issues. And I'm wondering, should there be a citizens course at some point in our lives where we learn these skills? Would you like your book to be a textbook in a way, or a guide where people can learn this beyond in the library, getting a copy of your book or purchasing it or reading about it at your blog? How can we really help shift culture?
That's a great idea. I would love it if people were to use it. And just to mention, there are a number of additional resources available on talkingtoyourdoctor.org, which is the website associated with the book. I think people, it's interesting, you know, you think as a provider, you take for granted the fact that you have been navigated into or you have benefited from other people's tour for you of the healthcare system. You got to know it through whatever school you attended, as whatever provider you are. And people, patients don't get that. An ordinary person does not know the healthcare system until they run into the wall of it, you know, sometimes at full force. I just got a message from the emergency room that my colleague is attending to about someone who I'm seeing later this week, but they went to the emergency room for, I think, the same condition. And there are many reasons why this might happen in any particular case, but the research shows recently, and this is a recently published study, that people often think that the ER is giving them better attention, or the hospital is giving them better attention than their primary care provider, because there's availability, because there's a sense of urgency, and because their primary care provider, for whatever reason, does not seem to have those virtues. So I think there's how to use the system the way it is, and there's how to understand why people use it the way they do, and I think we need to address both things.
Well, that's very interesting, given that we're hoping that the remodeling and restructuring of our healthcare system will create better community-based care, mm-hmm. and some of these ideas that we're discussing today probably can be a full 5 hours of conversation. Can you talk more about the data that supports this idea that better communication actually results in better health outcomes and also savings of money and time?
I think the first one is the easiest. There are a number of studies done over the past few decades showing that, for example, if there is a more patient-centered encounter in, for example, the care of patients with HIV/AIDS, that leads to better clinical outcomes. And the same has been shown in other settings, for example, patients with depression, diabetes, with sickle cell disease. So as far as clinically, that is measuring the numbers that healthcare providers often measure, there is good solid evidence. Now, is that evidence true the same way in every disease for all people is obviously a different question. Whether or not it leads to savings in time is also a very good question, which I don't think the literature has answered yet. One would love to say, you know, I would love to say, if you have a better conversation, you and your provider in the front end, you're gonna spend less time in the back end because there's gonna be less confusion, less cross purposes. That would be great to say.
It makes intuitive sense.
It makes intuitive sense, but I don't know if it's the case. And it might be, sometimes you invest in something and you don't get returns in the same units, right? You might have to invest time and not get time back, right? So I don't know if it's the case. There might be some corners in which it is the case. I can say that for monetary savings, there has been a great push over the past few years to try and centralize care, and make sure that we know what care patients are getting and why. And the shorthand for this is accountable care organizations. I won't go into all the details here, which Barbara probably knows much as or better than I do. But the big controversy is, do ACOs, accountable care organizations, save money? Maybe. And then the other point to add to that is, do ACOs really encourage patient-centered communication? The answer to that is also maybe. So I can give you a yes on the quality, a who knows on the time, and a maybe on the cost.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair. Let's get some practical information out to our listeners, because the book is filled with them, and I know you have some key core areas that you address that you can share with us now. Of course, it's very in-depth in your book, but I'd like you to have an opportunity to give some key points of what you suggest in your book on talking to your doctor.
Sure. So I think if I were to summarize the contents of the book in one sentence, it would be, good health over time is based on a relationship between a person and their provider, and that relationship has to be actuated or supported by good communication. And how does good communication come about? It comes about through investment and time, and obviously we all know there are bad providers out there, and there are people with a lot of problems who aren't able to express them very well or might have their own personality difficulties. That being said, I think there are three things that come to mind from the book. One is that we all know time is limited, but through being mindful in the visit, we can use that limited time to our best advantage. We need to set the agenda. That is, we as people seeing our provider have certain things we want to be covered, and that's to our own advantage to figure out which issues those are and to prioritize them, while realizing that the person we're facing has their own issues that they need covered, and that every visit is going to be a negotiation. And I think the last point that comes to mind, of many points in the book, but the last major point, is that relationship involves emotion. An emotion, not necessarily a squishy thing, but sometimes a squishy thing, and sometimes something that not everybody is comfortable mentioning or dealing with. And I'm not talking about emotions like making everything a therapy session, but emotions that are the bedrock of a relationship. So gratitude, a listening nature, and also negative emotions, you know, frustration, fear. So to be able to identify those emotions and name them and try to understand the reasons they're there, that's another important part of the healthcare relationship.
Well, they're all three very significant points, but I want to go back to the setting the agenda. How would folks do that effectively? Is that something you prep prior to arriving? Should you do it in the waiting room? And what should be on that agenda? What may be important to me may not be important to another listener.
Yeah, I think it's going to take preparation. I advise in the book that unfortunately these days there are many layers before a person sees their doctor or their nurse. You know, there's the receptionist, there might be the nurse helping out the provider. So it's going to require framing in a positive way, that is placing a narrative around what the issues are and being able to say it not like a performer would, but with some degree of organization. And then I think the prioritization, how someone's going to make that list, is going to depend entirely on the person. Someone might think that the symptoms are most important and say, my elbow hurts, my stomach hurts, I have headaches, and that's their list. And another person might say, I want to talk about my diabetes, I want to talk about the fact that my sister was just diagnosed with breast cancer, I want to talk about my memory issues, and is that dementia? And so some people might talk about their problems in different terms than others.
So what happens if I do arrive and I know that it's a follow-up visit, and probably what's the average now on a follow-up visit, like 6.5 minutes or
something,
five and a half minutes?
Yeah, yeah.
And I arrive and sadly, it is a follow-up. I'm a person living with multiple health issues. It's a checkup for my hypertension, mm-hmm. and I also have diabetes. But in fact, my dog died this week,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
that's really what's on my mind.
Right.
And I show up and say, Dr. Berger, I'm just falling apart. My dog died.
Yeah.
Do you think a practitioner has time to talk to me about my dog dying, or is it time for me to get my work up to be sure that my diabetes is stable and my hypertension is under control with my medications?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, there's always going to be some squaring of the circle, right? There's always going to be life that gets in the way. And this is the problem where, you know, sometimes sensitive care and personal and person-centered care is at cross purposes to population-based and numerical care, which I think both are important, right? We need to provide good care for all of our patients that have diabetes, and sometimes you need to use numbers to figure out what quality care means. But on the other hand, if someone is rocked off their feet by an emotional catastrophe, you have to acknowledge that and you have to deal with it. And sometimes you're going to lose a visit or gain a visit, you know, depending on how you look at it, right? Sometimes you're not going to be able to deal with what you wanted to deal with. And I think that's okay. You know, I think some other people, and it's obviously going to vary from provider to provider. Some people have less tolerance for that. And what I encourage in the book is sometimes you're going to have to train your doctor, right? You're going to have to say, look, I need to talk about this. And I think some people are trainable, some people aren't. That's just the way things go. But I think some people, you know, if you're able to say to a person, look, I need to talk about this, I think a lot of people will be able to listen to that. So, you know what, let's leave the blood pressure for next visit. Let's talk about this.
Yeah. Well, isn't that's the kind of practitioner that I want to see. I want to mention that, and I want to own that I'm in a different situation. One, I have access to health insurance. Two, I'm a registered professional nurse and see myself as a feminist activist. And having said that, I've actually fired two practitioners,
mm-hmm.
And I actually told them that I fired them. One was a pediatrician for my children, and the other time it was a gynecologist that I was seeing. And although I actually told them that I fired them, and it was because of really terrible communication issues and the way I was being talked to, I was terrified to do it. So I raised that as a possibility, but not always accessible based on the fact that it's an expensive decision, because then you have to start again with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think there are times where the match just doesn't work?
Yeah, like any other situation in life. You know, there are times where I think, you know, if we were to model the relationship between you and to someone and their healthcare provider to other relationships in our life, it's not really family. It's more like a partnership, like other partnerships we may have, like a business partnership or a life partnership. And so sometimes, yeah, it's not going to work out. And that could be a terrifying thing. And it's especially terrifying, I think, for the patient when doctors switch off for no reason other than there's a natural transition. You know, if someone is being seen in a clinic with house staff, you know, with residents, you know, junior doctors, and as we know, they change every 3 years, more or less. That's a real dislocating feeling to know that your doctor's going changing, not because of anything you did, or not because of anything they did, but because the wheel's turning, right, and have to rebuild everything all over again. That's quite a feeling, right? And or that, you know, if someone's moving, so just to deal with that is a huge deal. And but yeah, sometimes that relationship doesn't work out, and people have to start anew. I feel like, and again, I don't have much empirical support for this, but I feel like investment goes a long way. And people say, oh, I can't stand my doctor because of such and such. Well, did you tell them? Well, no, I felt really nervous. You know, you don't talk to your doctor that way. Well, I think you should, right? I think you should say, I didn't like that you did X. And there are ways to say it, and there are ways not to say it.
Well, we're about out of time, and I think it's a good time to remind our listeners that they can find out more by accessing your book, Talking to Your Doctor, which is published by Rowan and Littlefield. My guest this evening was Dr. Zachary Berger. He's a physician and a researcher. He's a primary care doctor and internist, as well as an epidemiologist and assistant professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. You can find out more about the book at Zach's website, which is
talkingtoyourdoctor.org.
There's lots of resources on there, and as you can see, this conversation is the beginning of what can be many conversations to help us all be more aligned with who we are and what we need, and then to be able to communicate that to the providers that we seek out for our health and well-being. Thank you for joining me this evening.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Barbara Glickstein. You're tuned into Health Styles, brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. Find out more about us at centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. Thanks for tuning in, and stay tuned.